From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, an urgent message for humanity. Wonder what that's all about. Here's what's happening. Attorney General William Barr said the Justice Department has not uncovered evidence of widespread voter fraud that would change the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. His comments come despite President Donald Trump's still repeated claims that the election was stolen and his refusal to concede his loss to President-elect Joe Biden. Thursday night, for the first 2 hours, researcher and author Jerome Corsi joins us. His latest e-book is called Trump Wins. I'm looking forward to talking with Jerry because he thinks that's going to happen. I can't see it happening, but I'm looking forward to talking to Jerry to see what he says. Numerous governors throughout the country have reinstated safety precautions in recent weeks to combat what they think is the rapid spike in coronavirus cases just weeks before large family gatherings and getaway trips traditionally planned for the holidays. Now, more than 11.5 million cases have been reported in the United States since the COVID-19 pandemic started in early 2020, and public health officials are fearing holiday travel will continue to let this spread. Meanwhile, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, has laid out a timetable for when sports teams will likely be able to pack stadiums and arenas again. It's not good. The NBA will be the first major sport to make a second return this year as the threat of the pandemic continues to grow. And according to Fauci, it could be some time before arenas like the Staples Center in downtown Los Angeles will be sold out. In the United Kingdom, restaurants, bars, cinemas, sports venues may require proof that people have received the COVID-19 vaccinations in order for them to visit. The UK's vaccine minister said getting vaccinated should be voluntary, but that a phone app used for contact tracing may include a person's vaccine status, which businesses could use to decide if they're going to let people in. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, I've got some things to ask you, but I want your thoughts on how we stand with COVID right now.
Well, it's spiking all over the country. I mean, it's really raging out of control right now. And it's really worse than it was at the peak of the crisis back in April. I mean, Los Angeles County today recorded over 7,000 cases
and they're shut down.
And they've shut down outdoor dining. Although, you know, it's ironic.
Well, they've shut down indoor dining too.
Well, of course, that's been shut down for months.
Right.
But the interesting thing is, you can drive to Pasadena and eat outdoors, even though Pasadena is technically L.A. County. So, you know, the rules are so inconsistent. Everybody's worried about the spike coming from, you know, the Thanksgiving, which, you know, this incubation period takes between, you know, 12, 14 days. And seeing, you know, hospital, you know, they're very concerned about, you know, hospital occupancy, you know, right now, really at about 75% in California, according to, you know, the data that I just read. And, you know, that's where, you know, they have it, all the public health officials and the governor panic because, you know, you start getting, you know, they're predicting, you know, overflow at 107% of hospital capacity, you know, in the middle of December. That would not be a good thing, George. And so, you know, we're talking about a lot of deaths, vaccines on the way. The campaign, as you know, did not help things in terms of creating any kind of public perception of safety with respect to the vaccine. First-hand reports of phase three subjects who took the vaccine, at least the Pfizer, you know, the memory RNA vaccine of Pfizer, the Moderna vaccine, by the way, is the same one. Why Pfizer and, you know, created a vaccine which it has to be transported at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit, packed in dry ice, is beyond anybody's imagination.
Yeah. The other ones, you don't have to be that cold.
Vaccine doesn't have to be.
That's right. Exactly. And, John, I've talked to some medical experts, and some of them are beginning to think it might not be a smart idea to shut down everything, that, one, open everything up, Two, let people decide if they want to go out or not on their own, and let people build up an immunity to what could be a disaster.
Well, and I think that's what, you know, they talk about with herd immunity. Even Fauci was talking, which is kind of crazy. I really criticized Scott Atlas, you know, his replacement on the Trump COVID task force for even breathing, you know, I mean, hinting at herd immunity. Now Fauci's talking about it, but he's talking about it in the context of vaccine. And think about this one, George. Even when this vaccine rolls out, and they're suggesting that maybe some first responders will start getting this vaccine in another couple of weeks, 3 weeks, it's going to take months for this thing, months, and maybe a year before the public at large is being vaccinated. You heard the reports in the UK saying that they're keeping vaccination records on cell phones for people and may not let them go into businesses. I mean, the CDC and the NIH are going to have to do an awfully good job to convince the American public to take this vaccine.
Yes, that's absolutely. And they got to take two doses. And God help us, John, if people start getting sick from these vaccines, because, you know, I think they're rushing it to marketplace.
They are going to get sick from these vaccines. That's what I was saying. The phase three people that participated had chills. They had high fever. They had exhaustion. They had all of the COVID symptom picture, but it only lasted 24 to 36 hours. The fact that you're going to give that to patients in nursing homes with comorbidities could be a real problem, since 6% of patients with COVID are in nursing homes, but 40% of the deaths from COVID in the United States are in nursing homes. So that could be a real problem on the horizon.
John, keep tracking this story for us. Appreciate it. And I wonder what will happen with people who have taken the flu shot and then they get the COVID vaccine. Is there any adverse reactions to that, too? A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers unveiled a $908 billion COVID relief bill aimed at breaking a months-long deadlock between Democrats and Republicans over new emergency assistance for small businesses, unemployed folks, airlines, and other industries during the pandemic. They're going to have to do something. Let's check in with advisor Charles Koppes. Chuck, do you think the stimulus is going to help?
Well, they're certainly hoping for that, and Wall Street is immediately responding to this news to help small businesses. States are in there, unemployment for people, and the airlines you mentioned. You know, small businesses account for 50% of all jobs in America. Think of that, 45% of our GDP. So, you know, Main Street's really hurting. And, of course, Wall Street responded. We got a new high in the NASDAQ today, 12,000 points or more, and 92% of the S&P is above their averages. So that seems to be good news. And, of course, you just mentioned the vaccine, George.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the CDC is making healthcare and nursing homes a priority, like John said. And they want to get 200 million vaccines by next October, probably more. But, you know, there's a new study by Harmony Healthcare. 70% are going to wait to take the vaccine because they don't know what it's going to do. 15% said they would never take the vaccine, and that's 50 million people.
That's right.
George, the CDC and WHO is calling this vaccine hesitancy. You're going to hear that word, and the need to educate people, persuade them, and so on. But, you know, I see this whole pandemic as part of a great reset. It's being planned by technocrats, the Davos crowd, new economic models. I'm going to be writing about that in my next free December newsletter. And if people want to sign up, they can do that at idpconsultinggroup.com. I'd be glad to send that along.
Great. Thanks. Do you have a link, Chuck, at your website, chuckkoppes.com?
Yeah, there as well. Just go to the homepage and put your name and email in.
Super. And we've got that link in our Twitter feed. Thank you, Chuck Koppes. Man, what a situation. And there's no question 2020 has been a rough year for many people. A new survey finds that 8 in 10 Americans are desperate to hear some positive news before the year ends. The study asked 2,000 people about the ways they've coped with the stress of 2020 and COVID-19. The results find that 75% said the constant stream of bad news has taken a toll on them. 7 in 10 respondents have made it a priority to do something positive every day as quarantine continues. And we'll also try to have some positive upbeat shows for you along the way as well. China has successfully put another probe on the moon. The robotic mission touched down a short while ago with the aim of collecting samples of rock and dust and will bring it back to planet Earth. So that's incredible. The lander expected to spend a couple days examining surroundings and then gathering up surface materials. In a moment, Martin Ball back with us on Coast to Coast. One of his books, Being Human. We're going to be talking about how the scientific and medical communities, as well as some municipalities, are agreeing that the benefits of substances which were previously believed to be addictive and illegal are proving beneficial to people. We'll talk with Martin about that next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Martin Ball back with us. Martin is an author, public speaker, podcaster, professor of religion. He specializes in psychedelic medicines with an emphasis on awakening and transformation. He's been a pioneer in the psychedelic renaissance in Oregon, where he has helped launch the movement to legalize psilocybin therapy. And Martin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back on, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
And how are things for you coping through this situation?
You know, like everybody, just doing the best that I can, making it day to day. And fortunately, a lot of the work that I do is online. You know, like yourself, you know, I interview people and I've got my podcast. And I can still do that, you know, socially distanced. And I offer online consultations with people, so I can do that as well. And I can sit here and write books and make music and make art all in my home office. So
good for you.
You know, making it through. Yeah.
What is psilocybin therapy? What is that?
Psilocybin therapy, yeah. So psilocybin is the active compound, well, one of the two active compounds that are in what are known as magic mushrooms. So this is a particular genus of mushrooms. These are found pretty much all around the world, and they contain these two different tryptamine molecules. One is psilocybin, and the other molecule is psilocin. And these are known as classic hallucinogenic compounds. And psilocybin therapy is the use of these compounds, generally in a lab-produced, and you know, so in a synthesized form, so it's in a very pure form. And it's used as an adjunct to psychotherapy, to treat PTSD, treat anxiety, treat depression, end-of-life care also. So there's actually a wide variety of uses for that. And what we're celebrating here in Oregon is that we just had an initiative that was passed. It was number 109, and that was the Psilocybin Services Initiative. And it just set up, it got passed by 56% here in Oregon. And what that's going to do is set up a two-year planning period that's going to get together health professionals and, you know, people working in the healthcare field and also in public policy, and get them together to decide what that program is going to look like here in Oregon. But of course, psilocybin and psilocin and magic mushrooms in general, these are something that are illegal at the federal level. So here, Oregon has taken the initiative to legalize this in our state for mental health care.
Martin, I've always believed that if these substances were legalized, that it wouldn't necessarily increase its usage, but if anything, would you know, help the lives of people who've been put in jail because of these things.
Yeah, and there's actually another kind of parallel movement that is taking place right now that's also known as the decriminalization movement, which is not specifically about legalizing any kind of form of therapy such as the psilocybin initiative, but the decriminalization movement is saying that these things should not be illegal because they don't really fit the category, they don't fit the classification at the federal level of what should be a Schedule I illegal substance. And this also, with the decriminalization movement, there's sort of a side movement to that, which is this idea of legalizing nature, that psilocybin mushrooms, they grow naturally all around the world. They grow here in Oregon. They grow in Europe. They grow in India and Asia, you know, so all over the world, and in South America and Central America. And you know, most of these psychedelic compounds are found in nature, but they've been made illegal, which, you know, it's just from a rational standpoint, is just somewhat absurd. Who are we to say that some aspect of nature should be illegal? And, you know, people's lives get ruined by getting put in jail for using these things. So there's a number of parallel movements that are taking place across the United States, and really this is a global phenomenon that's happening right now, where a lot of places are reconsidering whether they want to continue with the status quo of the war on drugs, or whether they want to look into decriminalization and stop arresting people and putting them in jail and ruining their lives for choosing to use these substances, and then also making them available at a professional healthcare level, because, you know, all the studies that have been done are really showing that there's a lot of medical benefits to these things. And they're not addictive, they're generally not dangerous, and they have lots of benefits. And they've also been with humanity for thousands and thousands of years. It's only until the modern age where we suddenly said, oh, all these things are bad and we have to make them illegal and put people in jail and ruin their lives because they use them, when humans have used them for thousands and thousands of years with a great safety record.
With the money we spend with the DEA trying to criminalize all these substances, putting people in jail, we're spending billions of dollars every year, billions of dollars. Couldn't we use that money, Martin, to legalize all this or decriminalize it and set up clinics and places like that to help people who might be addicted?
That's it. That's exactly the argument. So that also is what Oregon has done, right? That we passed an initiative that was number 110, and that decriminalized all drugs in the state of Oregon. And with that initiative, the idea was, let's stop putting people in prison for this, and for people who actually are addicted to an addictive substance, let's get them health care. And for people who are just using this for their own purposes and not causing any harm to anyone or themselves, you know, people use these substances for religious and spiritual purposes and for personal growth and creativity. And rather than directing money to policing and getting bigger guns and bigger SWAT teams and more armor for the police so that we can bust down people's doors in the middle of the night and drag them out for, you know, having a small amount of some substance, let's redirect our resources as a society into something that's actually more beneficial and more humane and more rational, because the war on drugs is really quite irrational the way that it's been run.
It's not working.
No, it's not working at all. And in its application, honestly, in most instances, it supports institutionalized racism because it gets directed towards minority communities more than anyone else. And so they're the ones who really bear the brunt of the war on drugs are minority communities. And it's not, you know, white people. So it's the whole system is, it's just a complete failure, and the amount of money spent on it is just astronomical, as you've mentioned.
Yeah, it's huge. What would we do with people who are illegally selling things like prescription drugs, Vicodin, Xanax, to other people? Would we keep that a crime?
Well, you know, the way that the laws are now, yeah, that is still a crime. Like the decriminalization movement, that's taking drugs that were illegal, such as everything from mushrooms to LSD to heroin and methamphetamine. They're taking these drugs that have been considered to be illegal, and they're saying, we're not going to put people in jail for that anymore. But now with prescription drugs, that's a different category of legal status in terms of there's already laws on the books for how those drugs are supposed to be distributed. Now with decriminalization, that's not opening the door to, say, setting up a shop on the corner where you can walk in and buy meth. That's not what decriminalization is. Decriminalization just means that we're not directing police resources to putting drug users in jail. Okay, so it's not opening up the market. See, that's where it's different with the psilocybin initiative. What they're saying is they're actually legalizing, again, which is different than decriminalizing. They're legalizing psilocybin therapy so that then, yes, you could open up a clinic and you have a set of ethical guidelines for this is how this business is supposed to be run, and it has to conform to state law and local municipal laws, and that then you can open up a clinic and that you can have someone who has severe depression or severe PTSD or, you know, a number of other issues for which people would seek out psilocybin therapy, and they could legally come to a clinic where they could have, in a professional and safe setting, they can have a psychedelic experience that can be therapeutic for them, and that we're able to address healthcare issues in a way through psychedelic therapy that really is, in some ways, is quite superior to, say, talk therapy or psychoanalysis.
Oh, absolutely. Martin, hold on for a sec. We're at the break. We'll come back and talk more, and we'll get into what is the psychedelic renaissance that is underway. And we'll take calls with Martin Ball next hour as we talk about the psychedelic renaissance. If you have used any substances and you want to share those stories with us, please do so as well. We'll be taking calls next hour. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Martin Ball with us. Martin, so the psychedelic renaissance is underway. Explain what that is.
Well, a psychedelic renaissance is kind of a phrase or term that's being used to talk about sort of this global phenomenon that is taking place right now, where people around the world are getting interested in psychedelics. And that, actually, just to share something a little bit fun with you that relates back to an earlier question that you asked me about how I was doing through lockdown and all of that.
Yeah.
I participated in the Psilocybin Summit, which is an online conference that was held based out of Mount Tamalpais in California. And I had interviewed the organizer for that event for my podcast. And during the interview, he said that I was a psychedelic renaissance man, and in a punny way, in the sense that I'm an artist, I'm a musician, I'm an author, I'm a public speaker. You know, I do lots of different things, and so I use that phrase of the renaissance man. And so then, you know, in the lockdown, not having much more to do, I sat at my computer and I decided to be fun to make official psychedelic renaissance men and women certificates. And so I made these certificates, and then I ended up emailing them out to colleagues of mine around the world, recognizing them as members of the psychedelic renaissance. But anyway, that was just a little fun bit about that. But the psychedelic renaissance is this, as I said, this phenomenon that's taking place around the globe right now. That, you know, we've already talked a little bit about, we had the war on drugs, which really got started back in the 1970s and really under Richard Nixon. And prior to that time period, there had been a lot of research that was taking place in universities around psychedelics, because they were looking at potential therapeutic uses, as we, you know, talked about in the last segment, that they were looking at what are potential uses for psychedelics. And also, this was something that was being used by intellectuals, by scientists, and by philosophers. They were using it to augment their own experience and their own insights into reality. But all of this was made illegal starting, you know, again, back in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And it shut down all research on psychedelics here in the United States, and then through the United Nations resolution about war on drugs, that this was basically made illegal all around the world. And it spread the war on drugs from the United States everywhere else. It was exported. And so all research into psychedelics was stopped, though it had been going on for decades prior to that. And at this point, also, we started to get bombarded largely with drug war propaganda that, oh, these are dangerous, you're going to lose your mind, you're going to think you can fly, and you're going to jump off a building, and, you know, they're going to come and get your kids, and, you know, all this hysteria around drugs. But now we live in an era where research around psychedelics has been renewed at research universities across the globe. This is happening in the United States. It's happening in Mexico. It's happening in Canada. It's happening in Brazil. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in the United Kingdom. This is going on all over the world now. And there's also been an explosion of conferences around psychedelic subjects. That, you know, 10 years ago, there were maybe three or four conferences around the world dealing with psychedelic substances. And now there's dozens of them. Of course, you know, like all conferences and all public events, they're kind of, everything's shifted to online, but they're taking place still now during the coronavirus and all of that. And there has been, beyond sort of the medical professional interest in psychedelics and the research that's being done, there also has been an explosion of interest at the spiritual, rather religious or personal level, where in, especially in Western cultures, you know, coming out of the last generations, there was really a great disenchantment with what gets called organized religion and sort of faith-based religion and the idea of follow the rules and you'll be rewarded in the afterlife or, you know, whatever. Many Westerners became disenchanted with that. And, you know, all of the public surveys show that fewer and fewer people in each upcoming generation identify as belonging to any particular religion. Yet many people still identify as being spiritual, that they have interest in spiritual experiences. And so we've seen not only an increase in interest in, say, meditation and yoga, but also in the spiritual and religious use of psychedelics. And this is also something that, again, is happening all around the world. And there are some religions that specifically have gotten religious freedom protections granted to them for the use of psychedelics as sacraments within their churches. And there's numbers of retreat centers, you know, all around the world. And of course, in the United States, there are many underground practitioners that make these experiences available to people. You know, like we were talking about in the last segment, you know, we're legalizing that at the therapeutic level for psilocybin here in Oregon. But this is history making. This is groundbreaking that no other state, no other country has made that legal yet. So we're kind of a pioneer in that area here in Oregon. These are all different aspects of the psychedelic renaissance. And it's also, of course, influential in music and in art. And we can see it actually in all different areas of culture where, you know, now on Netflix, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow got her Goop Lab show. And the very first episode was about psychedelic medicines, where she's interviewing Mark Hayden, who's the executive director of MAPS Canada, the multidisciplinary.
And you recently published his book, didn't you?
Yeah, that he put together a multi-author book, which is called The Manual for Psychedelic Guides. And so, yes, this is by Mark Hayden, the executive director of MAPS Canada. And he originally brought me on to the project as someone to just kind of review the book and then add anything that I might want. You know, he said, you know, that's at a professional level, you know, what would you add to this book? And so I added some things. And then he said, well, would you also like to edit it? And I said, sure, and I'll edit it. And then I wrote the foreword for it, and then I designed the cover for it, and then I ended up publishing it. So I became his publisher for the book. But this Manual for Psychedelic Guides really covers, you know, an important development within the psychedelic renaissance is now that people are coming above ground, now that this is becoming legalized and really the value and significance is being recognized at the academic and at the professional level, now there's a need for guidelines for what are the professional ethics within this new burgeoning profession of psychedelic therapy. What does it mean to serve people in a way that respects boundaries and consent and provides a safe and secure environment for people to have what are often very deep and cathartic experiences, which can also be challenging and also scary. So there's, you know, just so many ways that the psychedelic renaissance is happening around the world. And so these are just kind of little snippets of what it is. And it's also happening at a very regional level. Like I said, here in Oregon, we've just made some major changes. There's also the decriminalization movement is looking at specific municipalities. Like it started in California, in the city of Oakland.
Would you take people out of jail once these pass, who've been in for these offenses?
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's part of the conversation. You know, it's just like what's happening with cannabis, with marijuana, where now it's most of the states in the United States have legalized it in some form.
That's right.
And
that's
so
right.
Now there is, and really, like, cannabis is kind of, that's a psychedelic light in a sense. So it's kind of part of the psychedelic movement, but it's also its own thing. But that's certainly part of the conversation is, well, look, if we've been putting people in jail for marijuana and cannabis. We've got to let them out. And in fact, we might even owe them some reparations of some form for having taken part of their life away for something that we now recognize is relatively benign and that it really wasn't legitimate to put them in prison in the first place. And certainly that's part of the conversation around psychedelics. Now, psychedelics are not, in general, as widely used as, say, cannabis is. I mean, that's as many more users around the world, because it's a more casual experience. You know, psychedelic experience, you really have to commit yourself to in some respects. So I don't think that there's as many people really in prison for psychedelic usage. But that, I think, would be an important part of sort of this shift that we're having, that for people who have been imprisoned for, like, making a religious sacrament available in an underground religious community, which has happened, you know, people have been put in jail for making ayahuasca available for their ayahuasca church, that, yeah, I think those people, they should be let out of prison. Absolutely.
Would you support some kind of controlled substance for people so they don't buy junk off the streets if these things become legalized?
Yeah, that, you know, people really debate that a lot within the movement. So, you know, understand when you're asking me, you're getting my opinion, and there's lots of different voices.
Oh, absolutely.
Psychedelic
sure.
Renaissance. And I do support full legalization, which, again, is different than just decriminalization. The decriminalization is, again, we're not putting people in prison for it. But I do think that quality is important, that if people are taking psychedelic substances, that if it's all above board, if it's fully legalized and people can run a business off it, and then you can also maintain quality
control. monitor it, have things checked and stuff like that.
And then, of course,
almost like an FDA type thing.
Yeah. And you get tax revenue from that, and it only benefits the economy. So, you know, I really think it's a no-brainer, and that there's a place in the world for, you know, people to have their spiritual experiences with psychedelics, and there's also a place in the world for people to have a personal experience with psychedelics that, you know, not necessarily is about, as you know, therapy or about a spiritual experience, but maybe, you know, they just want to enjoy the creativity that comes with that, and that you should be able to go to a store and know that you're getting, you know, the right molecule, and that you know the proper dosage, and you know the safety precautions, and that by legalizing it, it makes all of that information more easily accessible for people. And then, yeah, you're not like buying something on a street corner and you don't really know, is this the right thing? Because, you know, there are considerations for, you know, people who are on various kinds of psychiatric medications. Sometimes they don't play well with certain psychedelic molecules. And so, again, the more above board all of this is, that we can have rational, accurate information about it, that it actually protects people's health.
What would it do to crime if everything was legalized? I mean, what would it do to the Colombian drug lords and things like that?
Well, they certainly wouldn't like it, because it's the illegality of drugs that fuels
the profit,
you know, the drug cartels, right? That
absolutely.
They don't want legalization, because then they actually lose their power. They lose their influence. You know, like here in Oregon, where we have both medical and recreational cannabis, you know, there's no crime syndicates around it. And, you know, it gives jobs to people, and we don't have to be secretly importing marijuana from Colombia or something like that, and, you know, evading the border patrol, and
I think street crime would go down, because robberies attributed to them wanting money to buy drugs illegally, if they were legal and they had access to it, they wouldn't be robbing as many people for this.
Yeah, it really changes the game. It changes the way that society is interacting with these substances. And the way that society is interacting with these substances right now and at the status quo level is highly dysfunctional. And so this is about really systemic changes that could be made that would be just, they're just beneficial. And, you know, the people who are against it, they all say, well, that's going to create more drug users and more addicts. And it's particularly when we're talking about psychedelics. You know, addiction is not an issue. These are not addictive substances, that they don't have that property. You know, again, the decriminalization movement that they are looking at also addictive substances that can be very destructive to people's health. But see, putting those people in jail isn't helping them. Stripping them of their rights isn't helping them. Giving them health care, that would help them.
And then, that would help them a lot. What if they were driving and stuff? Does it impair their driving abilities? Or, I mean, would you try to monitor it like, you know, alcohol consumption?
Yeah, well, in that sense, that's something that would need to be studied and then determined, like, what's a safe level and what's not a safe level. I mean, the same thing that we do with alcohol, that you have a blood alcohol content. And places that have legalized recreational marijuana and medical marijuana, you know, they've tried to develop systems for that. But in some odd ways, I mean, I am not encouraging anyone to take a psychedelic and go driving, but it doesn't impair your abilities in the same way that alcohol does, and that each psychedelic itself is also different. And mostly, I mean, honestly, these substances, what they do is they provide people with an opportunity to go deep into themselves, deep into their own psyche, deep into their own minds and their own experience. And so people aren't taking psychedelics and driving around. What they're doing is they're taking psychedelics, putting on a beautiful playlist of music, closing their eyes, shutting themselves up in a dark room, and having a deep, cathartic, and possibly even profoundly spiritually transformative experience over the next few hours. That's what they're doing. And Martin, that's the way that people want to use them. Not I'm going to go on a joyride while I'm tripping. I mean, that's like the last thing you'd ever want to do.
We've got a couple websites for you. Do you have one that you really recommend people go to?
For me personally?
Sure. Or what you're doing, yeah.
Yeah, well, my main website is just martinball.net. It's fairly easy to find. But in terms of the services that I offer right now, I also mention my website, nondualentheogenicintegration.com. And this is where I offer people one-on-one sessions to talk to them about their psychedelic experiences and help them to integrate it in a way that's healthy and beneficial for them. And you know, I deal with clientele from around the world for that kind of work.
All right. Well, stay with us. We're going to come back and take a final hour of phone calls with you. If you have tried substances and they've altered you a little bit or helped you, why don't you share that story with us? Or perhaps you just have a question for Martin. We'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM.